Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with Kiwi journalist, broadcaster, and TV presenter Carly Flynn. Born and raised in Taupo, Carly has worked in the media industry for more than 20 years. Carly has been a host for a number of live news and entertainment shows, including Nightline, Sunrise, 3 News, News Hub Late, Prime News, in addition to her presenting roles with TV3's flagship affairs program Target, Choice TV's Cook the Books, and The Healthy Food Guide. Welcome to the show, Carly.
Oh, thanks, Jamie. It's nice to take a little trip down memory lane as I remember each and every one of those wee projects that I've worked on across the years.
I imagine for you, it is quite strange to think about how many areas you've managed to dip into.
Yeah, and it's nice to be reminded as well, because obviously time marches on and a lot of these things are long gone. And then sometimes you just have to remember some of the privileges that you've had and some of the cool jobs that you've had to make you feel good about the career that you might be suddenly in your mid to late 40s all of a sudden.
And if I'm looking back even further, and we're going to start at the beginning, which is where I do with a lot of these chats, you originally wanted to be a marine biologist. Now, what was the reason behind that, and why did you see marine biology as like the first thing you wanted to dip into?
Yeah, great that you picked up on that. It was that or journalism. And I think a couple of things with the marine biology, my mum's side of the family, my mum's mum was born in Fiji, born and raised in Fiji. And so my nan and pop had a beautiful place in a place called Ohiwa Harbour, which is on the eastern sort of near Whakatane. And that was where we spent a lot of our childhood, was with nan, catching fish, eating cockles, catching flounder, and always looking for the little intricacies on the beach. And she would always just, we'd just go for hours and just collect little shells. And she probably really sparked my love of the ocean and my love of finding little things and being curious. So that's probably where that started. As I grew older, I ended up diving. We've dived all around the world with lots of different sharks. And, you know, I've just always had this fascination and love of the ocean. But I think, to be perfectly honest, I probably didn't go down that pathway for a couple of reasons. But the main reason being I was never very smart at school in anything other than English. And so I didn't know a marine biologist. And I didn't know the pathway. Nobody in my family had done that. So it probably just, you know, I left school at the end of 16, at the end of sixth form, it probably just felt too hard. Whereas with journalism, you know, again, curious about people, curious about sharing stories. I did know people and I could see a pillar, you know, a beaming light of how that could operate. And so that just sort of became, I guess, the easier option. Yeah, and when I reflect on like right now, if I had have been a marine biologist, I love that world, but I get horrifically seasick, so I don't know quite if I would have been able to pull it off, because being on boats, you know, I have to take all sorts, and I still end up throwing up. So
yeah, because it's crazy, because your childhood was around island life. Like, I read about the fact that you grew up in Rarotonga, but then you moved at some point to New Zealand, to Taupo. In terms of that start, island life, growing up in that sort of culture, growing up in that sort of lifestyle, where do you feel like that's carried on through for the rest of your life? Do you feel like it has, or do you feel like that's like
absolutely.
A time that's been and gone?
Yeah, well, I think Nan and Pop's influence and their love of Fiji and, you know, Kokonda or Ikimata is still my hands down, you know, last day on earth, what do you call it, death row meal. I would have Kokonda every day of the week, raw fish. Because of Nan and just that real love of Fijians and Fijian culture. And so there's that side of it. But yeah, you're right. When I was about 12, we were actually living in Taupo, and my parents are both teachers, and they probably were at the age and stage of me now, really, wanting a bit of a change of scene, that whole midlife thing. And Dad got a job teaching in Rarotonga for 3.5 years. So I was 12. I was Form 2 intermediate. It was the worst news anybody could ever have told me. There was no way I was going. I was the eldest of 3 children, and there was no way he was going to rip me out of my life that I, you know, I'd been at one school, one primary school, one intermediate. I was in Form 2. I was, you know, on my way to whatever. And suddenly the family got, you know, in my mind, in my naive mind at 12 years old, ripped away and shoved in Rarotonga. And it was brutal at the start, the first 6 months for me. I missed my friends. I like, you know, I have this line that I'm sure is accurate, but it could just be a story that I've built in my head, but I was the only papa'a or white child my age of the year on the island. So suddenly I was didn't look like everybody else. I didn't act like everybody else. I didn't speak the language. And for the first 6 months, I absolutely hated it. While mum and dad were, you know, ginning it up and sailing and playing tennis, and my younger siblings were none the wiser, I absolutely hated it, and I missed Form 2 and what was going on in Form 2 back at Taupo Intermediate. And probably a bit of that was around the language, because at the primary school that I went to, you know, I was the new shiny thing that had the white skin and didn't speak the language. And I was wearing red rims, which made things even worse. And I felt really like a fish out of water. So it took a lot. It took a lot to turn that round. But once I did, you know, probably once I got to college and I met a few other papa'as and I got into the sailing, and then that was a mixed cultural sort of thing. And then the school spoke a bit more English, and there were a few other expats, but that sort of didn't, after a while, that didn't matter. Suddenly we, you know, I was never going to be in the Cook Island basketball team or in the Cook Island touch rugby team. I was, you know, this little skinny white girl from Taupo. But certainly by the time we came to leave, sort of 3 years later, again, went through the whole repeat cycle of, I can't bloody come home. Sorry, I probably shouldn't swear. You know, don't send me home. What am I going back to? I can't leave my wonderful, you know, Cook Island whānau, where we, you know, spent every afternoon unsupervised at the sailing centre, sailing our own little boats or swimming out to the motus and building fires and having marshmallows as teenagers. I mean, it was an idyllic life. And probably that's why I ended up leaving to go to do my journalism degree early, is because I came home at 15, straight into fifth form. The curious thing about that was that people were like, oh, hey, how's it going? Where have you been? And that was it. And I had this really massive life experience. So that kind of was a little bit hard, because how could you explain it? And that's probably why I left at the end of sixth form, just to go and find my own people again. But to your point of how it's shaped me, I'll always walk in other people's shoes first. I've got that absolute perspective now, plus this deep, deep love of, you know, Cook Island singing, the Cook Island drums, some Cook Island food, and just another culture, and knowing what it feels like to not be the apex culture in the room, if that's the right word. Yeah.
Yeah, the fish out of water sort of scenario. And I do love the fact that you touched on the blasé-ness of New Zealanders in general. Oh. The fact that you disappeared for 3 years and like, oh, finally, you're back. Yeah, does it what's still kind of feel... But yeah, what have you been up to? What's been going on? Yeah, that's so strange. And do you almost feel as well that cultural shift coming back was even harder? Because, yeah, you grew up in New Zealand, you're used to the culture, but then shifting, because I found the same experience myself. I've lived overseas for a number of years, and going back to New Zealand every time feels like a shock to me. It feels weird. Yeah. It doesn't feel right. Do you feel still the same way, that Rarotonga in a way feels more familiar than New Zealand sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. And I probably make a really conscious effort to really tune in and listen when I hear that people have been on an amazing experience, whether it's, you know, helping out in the Solomons, or I've got a friend that's just last week beautifully become engaged to a Fijian man who lives in Fiji. She lives in New Zealand, and she came back on Monday engaged, and I just want to make sure that I give her story the time and space, rather than, oh, hey, how was Fiji? You know, it's in lots of ways, like, actually, but I say that, and yet the doing of that is quite hard, because life is busy, and there's not often that space. But I do have some really good girlfriends that will go, hey, I really want to catch up with you about how XYZ went, and I therefore do the same to them, because otherwise there's no meaningful I don't find there's too many meaningful conversations in life these days. So yeah, it's worth making the effort.
And it's almost in the same respect in terms of, let's talk about effort, because you mentioned the fact that marine biology, there was no clear pathway. You weren't really sure where to go there, but you could clearly see there was another man in your life that was making that effort, was making those strides, and that was Mike Brockie, who was your godfather, who was a journalist. And I'm quite curious, when was it that you first kind of encountered him and first kind of realized, I think I really want to do what he's doing? Like, was there a particular pivotal moment, or was it you kind of heard in the grapevine the work he was doing? You're like, I need to know more about this.
Well, Mike and his former wife, Jen, are my parents, were my parents' best friends. They all went to school together in Rotorua, so they were always in our lives. They are my fairy godparents, for lack of being religious ones. And so Uncle Mike was always around, and Auntie Jen, and Auntie Jen still lives about 300 metres up the road from me now. Uncle Mike has since retired, and even when they split, I still worked with Mike in the newsroom. But yeah, I think probably at about 12, he might have ended up doing something like presenting some kind of random late night news show on TVNZ. Probably actually thinking about the big sort of the big idea came. He was one of the few that left, that exited TVNZ in 1989 or 1988 it was, I think, to go off and set up TV3, which felt so cool and rebellious, and because I knew this story, I mean, it could have probably been any person with any story, but that was the story that my 12-year-old self attached it to. And funnily enough, it wasn't actually about him, about being on television. Mike was never, you know, a television news presenter for long. He was always a story crafter. He was always an exceptional producer. But it was probably just that real, you know, spunk of doing that and knowing the person that was like sticking it to TVNZ and got marched down the building. And that probably sparked the curiosity more than anything. And then I think my parents are both English teachers, so, you know, naturally, potentially, I always loved writing a good story and was into drama and theatre and all that kind of thing. But again, getting into journalism school was never about presenting, thankfully, because I think if you do set out to be like that, I mean, goodness, the kids these days that want to ask me how to get on TV, it just makes my skin crawl, because a true talent, I think, and this is what Mark Jennings, who ended up putting me and so many other people on screen, did. They, you know, yes, I guess sometimes you badger away and you get on TV, but most of my colleagues were surprised to get that break, and it wasn't something that they worked towards, because, you know, sitting in a studio by yourself, particularly a news studio, different if you're doing interviews, radio interviews, etc., but sitting in a news studio by yourself, there's nothing sort of, you know, feeding back to you on that. You know, you're not having any meaningful conversations with anyone but a camera and then some shits and giggles with the crew and the air brakes. So, yeah. Yeah, that was a long answer.
but it's a good answer. No, but it's a great answer, because I think you're right. I think a lot of people have this misconception when they go into media in general, and I certainly know from having done broadcasting school that on those first few weeks, you see how many people want to be hosts, presenters, front of cam. They want to be the star. Yes. They want to be the celebrity or the influencer or whatever. And then very quickly you realize they're like, oh, no, I don't think I can do this. This is impossible. Like, one, I don't have the personality to do it, or two, I don't think I actually have the knowledge base to do it. And, it's, as you said, it's usually the people sometimes in the background that are just grafting away who will usually get given the opportunities because their knowledge is just so good. They've got the craft. They know what they're doing. So, yeah, I find that, like, crazy.
And it's so subjective too, right? Like, it depends on your completely. Bosses, you know?
Yeah, massively.
Yeah, so you just don't know. You don't know, and when I think about it now, I think about how there were a few more opportunities that I should have said yes to, but I didn't, or I didn't put, I, you know, because I've never been particularly good at batting for myself, going into bat for myself. I've always been, I think, because it sort of came at me and then it happened and then it got taken away and then I sort of, but I wasn't one. So it's a hard mix, right? Because if you want it, you do have to go after it. But if you don't have the self-confidence and you're waiting for somebody to rely on your natural ability or what they've seen before, then it's not going to come to you either. So probably, I haven't gotten it right by any stretch of the imagination.
Is it the kind of like the idea of sticking your neck out and kind of like putting your ego almost in check, in a sense of being like, I'm putting myself so far out there, and if I get cut down, I don't know how I can like come back from it? Is it a little bit of that? Or
absolutely. Absolutely. And yet you get other people that like go hard, you know, they get the whole hair and makeup and the nails and the practice and done, and you know, and have an absolute strategic plan around how to get jobs, and typically if they've got the natural ability side as well, and they'll get the job. But just sitting back in the, you know, as a wallflower and hoping that you get picked doesn't work out, maybe except for the very first time.
But ironically, you say all this, but you were going out, and as you mentioned a little earlier, at 16, you went to university. You went to go study journalism, which is not something that a lot of people do. A lot of people leave it to finishing high school, doing the whole thing, doing the whole rafts, and then maybe going to university to study journalism. What made you think, I need to do this now at 16? Like, I can't let this wait. I need to grab the saddle and start writing now. What was the reason?
You'll laugh. Both my parents were teachers at my high school. So there was no flipping way that I was going to stay another year. No way. So I applied at the end of sixth form. My best friend was at the end of seventh form. We both applied. We both got in. I was probably going to be like deputy head girl or head girl in form seven with both my parents as teachers. No way. No. So when I got in, mum was like, oh, you got in. Great. But you're not going to go, are you? And then the trickiest thing for them after they got over the fact that, yes, I was that there's nowhere for a 16-year-old board in Hamilton when you're a first year, because the halls of residence wouldn't take me. And then the ones off campus wouldn't take me because they didn't want responsibility. And then, so that nearly scuppered me. But thankfully, mum and dad believed in me and my passion. And my best friend, who was a year older, was going in as well. So they managed to talk them around and let me in. Yeah, and I completed my degree, did my degree, did a diploma as well, and just absolutely loved it. I loved it. Not in a gotcha journalism ever kind of way. That's never been my style. I've had to do it all, but really, I just like hearing people's and sharing people's stories.
And do you think that's also another misconception in journalism, that a lot of people think it's always going to be the gotcha journalism? It always has to be this brutal cutting thing, like doorstepping people, running after the cars, getting the big scoop. Do you think that's also an area that maybe a lot of people don't realise? Like, the journalism circle is a lot wider than just having to always feel like competitive in a sense.
Yeah, I do. But equally, I felt that as well as a young journo, and sometimes even as a more senior journo. I did all of those things in my early career, in my early 20s, sort of going up to probably late 20s. And a lot of the times it didn't feel right. You know, I was on things like the Arena Asher case. I would have to go and door knock people. I would have to try and, I spent a lot of my sort of crime journalism career in South Auckland, where probably I did get some good stories, or I did get access to people that others weren't, because I had that Polynesian, Fiji, Rarotonga influence. So I knew some cultural things around that. But that stuff never sat well with me. But there certainly was a time, and probably in my heyday as a journalist at 3 News, where, when you had your Mel Reeds, Andy Brotherstons, Bob McNeil was just a beautiful soul who got to do whatever he wanted, which was just amazing. But, your Tony Cyprian's head of sports, like, you had to be this kick-ass, hard-nosed, what's the alternative view, what are the facts, but don't let your own opinion come out in any shape or form, do a live cross. It was brutal. And I remember once pitching to them, because I like to see the good in life, and I like to see the good in people, and again, like to understand the other side of the story, or try and walk in other people's shoes. And so I remember I pitched doing something like The Good News, and just got laughed out of the room by my middle-aged, senior, white, male producers. And it's just timing. A lot of media is timing, because if you look at Paddy Gower right now, that's exactly what he's doing. I'm like, damn it. I was about 15 years too early, or Hayden over on TVNZ with Good Sorts. And I guess moving out of news and moving into something like Sunrise, which then boosted me into things like all my radio shows and other lifestyle TV shows, that's when I did get to have good conversations and talk to good people. And there was no, I wasn't trying to catch them out on how they cut a onion, or I got to have a bit more fun, and I got to be a bit more me, because I was never very good at playing the two sides. As a journalist, you've got to go out and get the two sides, And I guess I'm a people pleaser and I like to be liked, so I would always find it hard. I will share one story with you where that really became quite evident. It was the night before, the day before the election, when Helen Clark was going for her fourth term as the Prime Minister of New Zealand. And John Key was this newbie that was challenging her. Must have been the day before the election, like maybe the Friday, and the election would have been Saturday. And typically in that era, so this is probably 2009, 2008, can't remember exactly. And I actually heard Ali Moore talk about this recently, so it was a TVNZ thing as well. But typically on those morning shows, the Mail would do the political interviews. And Oliver Driver, who wasn't a journalist, would always assume that he would always do the hard news interviews. And a lot of the time I sort of went, oh, yeah, that's fine. I'll talk to Linda Helen about gardening. Or I was happy, you know, because I was happy. Although I did still obviously do hard interviews, so I'm talking probably more around the hard political ones. But the morning that Helen was coming, and I was like, I'm going to take this one, because we'd always had quite a good relationship. And I, you know, asked the normal questions and then, you know, said something, I can't remember what the words were, but it was the sentiment would have been something along the lines of, you know, but Key's shaping up pretty good. What if you don't win on Saturday? You know, or something like that, trying to put my one hard question in. And her whole face changed. You could just visibly see her, because she didn't expect it from me, right? And I felt terrible. Oh, no. She changed. She didn't win. And then
did I ask a question that broke her? Like, yeah. Oh, no.
But also, you know, had it have been Ollie or Hosking or Henry was on the couch, TVNZ at the time, of course they would have asked those questions. But, yeah, I guess maybe it was more my reaction to her reaction that is more memorable than hers. But, I'll leave it at that.
It is, yeah, because in a way you do kind of have to have a certain personality. And by the sounds of it, TV3 was really trying to push the envelope in terms of being like the rebellious sort of station. And even I think up until recently, the network was kind of like the rebellious like child that was being like, we're going to do everything different from TV1 and TVNZ, and trying to always push the envelope and make sure that we're doing something that's kind of a bit racier. So yeah, I can understand your feelings about being a little bit worried sometimes about what people are going to think. So that's a really interesting take, and I wouldn't have expected that from yourself, Carly, because it must have been quite hard for yourself to be like where do I go from here? Like, I'm not sure how I feel about this morally. Like, I feel like
I wanted her to win, you know, personally at the time. I'm a swing voter. I'm not, you know, it depends on the time for me, but probably, you know, she was a known quantity. I liked her. We'd had a good relationship, and then I felt like I'd upset her, which was, you know that you're never going to be a good hard news political journo when you're worried about upsetting somebody from a question like that. That was, as it turned out, the thing that did happen.
Yeah, that's crazy. And in terms of where you actually started your career, because we've fast forwarded and gone back quite a few times.
Yeah, sorry.
This is perfect, because I feel like this kind of really gets to the bottom of the fact that you have worked across a massive stream of different areas. You originally worked in newspapers, is that correct? That you ended up working for the Herald for a little bit and then shifted to some community radio, Manuka Radio, as well as also moving through to Prime TV, which was your first kind of TV appearance. Or TV work, in terms of, like, that's quite a short succession. And how long was that period of you jumping between these different periods? Was it quite quickly that you were moving through these motions, or no? Because I have to remember you started at 16. So when was the first professional role for you, Carly?
So at the end of third year journalism, once you finally got the blimmin' T-line, 80 words per minute, which I think people still, I don't know if they still have to do it, but typically you get it on your last day when you've got to do your shorthand. And I think at the Waikato course that I did, by the third year they'd siphoned out the PR and marketing, maybe the more visual arts, and then communications with journalism, either broadcast and print journalists were left. And I think there was about eight of us. So in those days, this is in the late 90s, I think I graduated in 97, it was great, because they didn't put more people into courses than there were jobs in the world. And so there were about eight or nine of us that graduated at the end of that third year, three-year degree. And then you just get, well, I did, you get absolutely scared about what's next, because I didn't want to go back and live in Taupo with mum and dad. And, you know, I've done this degree and I'm on my way and I want to be a journalist. And so I applied and I got my first job my last week at journalism school, and ended up at so the Herald used to have a community group. They had Our Town, Papakura, Marurewa Weekly News, and the Papatoetoe in Otahu, something or other. There were three little rags that were based out of the Herald building. And for me, it was perfect because we had three rags, three different audiences. Two out of three of them were very Pacifica. But we had the overarching leadership of some really great senior Herald journalists running these three rags. So we had three deadlines a week. We were in court, we were in schools, we were, you know, we're covering all the civic stuff of South Auckland across those three areas. Spending a lot of time with the cops, following them around on drug busts. You know, I was 19 years old, I was having the time of my life. And then I got the call, because and I don't know if this is naive, and I still say this, but I haven't said it for a long time, so I'm not sure if it's accurate, but I always felt that with newspaper journalism, it was the written word, and so, and no offence to print journalists, but things could be taken out of context. Ironic when you think about what's done now with TV and radio. But to my mind, in radio and TV, I thought if I saw the horse, if the words coming out of the horse's mouth, then that was, well, I couldn't manipulate that. So I always felt that broadcast journalism was a more, not pure, but a more accurate reflection of a story. Naive, of course, because of course you can manipulate broadcast news stories as well. So I jumped over into Matthew Hooton's, he used to own a radio station called Counties Manukau News, and it was based in the backwaps of Papakura, and that was where I got, so I wanted to be on air from a news reading point of view. I wanted to get my voice skills up, and so that's where I went. I was doing 5 days a week, reading 10 bulletins a day and gathering the news as well for Counties Manukau News. So I did that for a wee while, and then Matthew actually opened up the Manukau Daily News, which was meant to be in competition with the Herald. And that got a good couple of years, and those were fantastic heydays. Worked with, you know, Winston Allworth, Paddy Gower, Rachel Grumwell. You know, there were probably about 15 of us that got dumped into this really exciting startup called the Manukau Daily News that flew for not particularly long, but I still worked in the radio, but we cross-referenced. So I went there. That was cool. Met lots of like-minded people and loved the Auckland life. But then Prime Local News came calling back in Hamilton, and I'd never thought anything. You know, I had enjoyed my time in Hamilton, went back to Hamilton and started working Prime Local News. So I was there for 3 years, and that was my first proper television job, where we were scrambling to Tauranga, to Tikawiri, and it was in the days, and I still think New Zealand media is poor at this, where, you know, there are a lot of stories that come out of different parts of New Zealand. Waikatoa Bay of Plenty was full of them, and we never failed to fill our bulletin 5:30 every night with good quality stories. And we just learnt the craft, you know, doing two stories a day, collaborating with a camera operator, an editor, a producer, a graphics person. We were all probably sub 25, you know. I actually ended up becoming the executive producer of that show when I was about 21, and running the team of about 20 of us. That ended badly because it broke me, because it was a really big job for a 21-year-old. But it was fundamental. And Paul Holmes actually gave me a ring during that time, because it was about the time that he, it might have been a little bit later, that he had defected and gone to the Albany offices and started the Albany, you know, Carly Kirkwood, come and talk to us. And, this is when I was back in Auckland, but we'd just bought our, I must have just moved to Hamilton. And so I turned him down, because people pleaser. I was like, I've just accepted this role in the Waikato, and I know. Well, I don't know. I mean, that all ended horrifically badly. at Prime. If you think about Ali Moore and a few others that all went there, I'm not sure what sort of life they had while it was on, but it didn't end well. Mind you, neither did Prime Local News, because that all went tits up as well. So, yeah. Yeah, so by the I think I got to about 22 and I was burnt out, and I'd run this team in the Waikato completely autonomously with a couple of people sitting up in Albany but not really caring about us. I had probably 20 staff, you know, young staff, had to deliver a news bulletin every day. And I met my husband at Prime Local News. He was a cameraman, gave him a pay rise once. And
I was actually going to ask you about
that. Still got the letter. Yeah, still got the letter to prove it. Yeah.
Is it weird looking back on that time? Because, were you a scrappy young journalist that was coming up through the ranks, you're managing a massive team. You meet your husband, who you were managing him and giving him a pay rise. Yeah. Like, is it kind of weird to look back?
Gave them all pay rises.
Yeah, gave him a good pay rise. Exactly. Yeah. Is it weird to look back and be like, I did that much in such a short amount of time? Because a lot of other people wouldn't have been able to have such a varied career in such a short amount of time. Like, that's a 5-6 year period, and you've gone from starting a print, going to radio, going to TV, leading a team. Like, do you not look at like how crazy that is? No,
I don't really. I mean, but I do with wisdom now go, oh yeah, that's why I had a breakdown. You know, that's why it was too much. So, you know, dealing with personalities and budgets and the daily grind. At 22, I pulled the pin on that, and then a month later it died, Prime Local News, and Dave and I decided to go and live in Ireland for a couple of years just to get out of Dodge. I hadn't wanted to go and do my OE prior, because I was so focused on getting New Zealand experience. And I don't know if this is still true, but journalism jobs were really hard to come by and were really competitive. And so I needed to get some New Zealand experience before we went overseas. And then got world experience in different ways in Ireland, worked on reality TV shows. And actually, ironically, a radio show called Today FM, where I was the early morning producer for an incredible broadcaster, Hosking-esque, called David McWilliams. Loved that, but then went into like a pop stars thing for 9 months, where we toured the country with Kerry Katona and Brian McFadden and Ronan Keating and those kind of people, auditioning singers from all around Ireland. And I think that's when I saw that reality TV is not for me, because I was like, no, I can do this here, but I cannot do this in New Zealand. I'm going back to do proper journalism in New Zealand.
Do you think that's kind of like a big fear? Because I've noticed this with a couple of ex-colleagues of mine. There's this big fear of like, I need to have a set amount of experience before I can go anywhere. And in the same respect, I can't leave a job unless I've been here for X amount of time. Do you feel like that adds a lot of extra pressure for anyone who's coming up in journalism, and especially for yourself? Because you said 22, you cut the cord. You're like, I can't do anymore. Like, do you feel like the pressure got to you at the point where you felt like you had to be there at all points, and it wasn't until a breakdown that you realised, like, I can dip out of this? Like, there has to be a breaking point?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, though, because I think, and I'm not sure about grads these days, but I do have quite good intel of my, like, you know, sort of junior to mid team, because I got the absolute privilege of going back into News Hub a couple of years ago and doing their late night news again, which I hadn't done for about 10 years. And with that, and because the time had passed, I found myself in this unique position of being like the old dog trying to learn new tricks, and also having these wonderfully passionate, exceptionally talented young people working with me. And what I see from them is that, like, they are all kicking butt in London. They're not scared. They, you know, back in my day, we had, like, Lucy Hawkins went to BBC London, and that was about it, you know. I couldn't name another person, really, that was a Kiwi, whereas, you know, Rebecca Singh, Nikki Omer, those are two people from Emma Keeling, three from my era that went probably 10 years ago and are working in different facets of the broadcast industry in the UK. But we're actually heading over for the first time, taking the family in a couple of months. And if I want to catch up with, I mean, the entire TV3 newsroom is sitting in a London pub on a Friday afternoon. And they're all, you know, mid to late 20s to mid 30s. And I don't know if, I don't know how that's come about, that there are jobs and there are openings and that it's become so accessible to them, because they're all doing really flipping well. You know, Isabel Ewing is presenting the news in somewhere like, I know, is it Tel Aviv or somewhere absolutely incredible at the moment. And I just feel like these younger journalists and younger broadcasters, they're so confident on camera. And they're so footloose and fancy free from a nomadic kind of perspective. They're not tied to New Zealand journalism. You know, Mitch McCann has set himself up in the US, like front and center of everything Trump. I think he's a freelancer. He's doing that off his own back. You know, it's amazing to see what they're doing. I think the sadness is that a lot of them, I don't know that anybody's ready to come home yet, but I don't know that they know what there is to come home to, and that might be where the career shift has to come in.
I'll definitely speak to that as well, and I love the fact that you dropped Mitch in there. He was actually a classmate of mine at
Oh,
broadcasting school, and a fantastic broadcaster. And yeah, I've been following his
phenomenal
career as
guy.
well, and it's
Yeah.
incredible to see what he's doing. And I think you really hit the nail on the head about the whole opportunities outside of New Zealand and what is there to come back to. And I can speak
Yeah.
from my own perspective that that's exactly my thought, and the reason why, sadly, I haven't gone back to New Zealand is because I felt like the industry isn't able to support the amount of people that are coming out that do have the talent, or there just isn't the roles available, frankly,
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is kind of interesting because even at that point, were you kind of feeling like that was the situation for yourself when you made that switch to Dublin? Did you feel
Yeah.
like that was kind of what was slowly happening to New Zealand?
Yeah, I guess for me, when we were in Ireland, like we ended up coming back because I was desperate to get into three. Like I hadn't been at three until then, and Hilary Barry had been the most amazing work experience person. I'd had a couple of like 1 month chunks at TV3. So I knew that we were coming back to get to TV3, because TV3 to me then, and side note, I always wonder what it would have been like if Uncle Mike had have been at TVNZ and I'd become a TVNZ girl, if my career would have been longer, because people at TVNZ always seem to last a little bit longer than people at TV3. But to me, there wasn't. Well, when I say there wasn't the opportunities in Ireland and the UK, I didn't ever try in the UK. But in Ireland, yes, I got to work a little bit at their version of TV3. I got to work at, as I say, at Today FM on their morning show and on this pop star. But they were not okay with non-Irish voices on air, so it was a lot harder. And I don't know what the UK would have been like. But you know, the BBC and ITV were all like, "Oh." You know, this is back when Graham Norton was just doing his comedy stand-up shows down the corner, in the middle of Dublin before he became really big. So they were very parochial about who they put on air, like that you'd never get on air. I was actually in Ireland with my friend Rachel Smalley, and she did get to go on air on TV3, and that was a bit of a coup. So coming back home for me, TV3 still felt like this beacon, like it was still a mountain to knock off, and yeah, came home and both of us got in there on as contractors straight away, and then within, you know, weeks or months or whatever, we both managed to get contracts. So, and that was the start of that. That was the start of the actual TV3 era. Yeah.
Yeah, the big era. And I think this is where it gets interesting for me because I remember following you and your career on television. Like, I was a lot younger, but you're probably one of the more recognizable faces on TV3, especially with Nightline being like a bit of a staple in my household. Probably because my dad was doing the late hour shifts and staying up
Yeah.
till about 10 o'clock at night. So I definitely remember seeing your face quite frequently. And does it kind of feel funny looking back as well that there was just this moment in time where you're wondering when that opportunity was going to come and then it finally came? What was it like when you took over on Nightline? Because that would have been back
Oh.
in what, 2007 or even
Yes, I think it
earlier.
was even earlier, I think. At the time, I was the youngest, and people in the newsroom were saying, "But you're way too young to be fronting this." It was a controversial one, that one. And I later heard that good old Uncle Mike was called into the room with Mark Jennings to say, "We're choosing between this person and this person," and Uncle Mike didn't choose me. So I still need to have that conversation with him at some point in my future. But thankfully, Mark Jennings overruled him. Look, it was exciting. It was terrifying. I felt, you know, Caroline Robinson had been in the role for a number of years. She was going off to have her third baby. And prior to that, it was Leanne Malcolm. So two exceptionally, I just couldn't believe it, to be honest. It didn't feel real, and I probably had imposter syndrome for most of my time on Nightline. The thing about the late news is that what you see is the late news, and it's that very perfunctory half an hour of late news with a little bit of fun and frivolity. But it's actually the team in the late news that makes the late news, like Angus Gillies, my favorite producer of all time. You know, Nikki Omer, who was our arts reporter. We had David Farrier got a start with us on Nightline. Like, he was at my autocue operator, and Jesse Peach and Jono Hutchison, these exceptionally talented young men, and the giggles and the laughs and the camaraderie, because we were the naughty kids in the corner versus 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock was scary. People would yell at people at 6 o'clock, whereas on Nightline we'd come in, we'd all have dinner together at 5:30, and we'd watch the 6 o'clock news, and then we'd try and make ourselves different at nighttime. So that was a team, particularly in the Nikki Omer, David Farrier, Angus Gillies and myself era. I just had the time of my life. Like, they're all wordsmiths, so, you know, the back and forward on the best words and coming up with the best headline, and that's the dance and the beauty of being in a tight newsroom. And I miss that probably more than anything, because in the end I actually hated being on air by myself. I actually found it really quite terrifying and had some real anxious moments around it, which played into the decision to go into Sunrise early morning, where even though I'd have to get up at 3 a.m, it meant that I was on air with friends and I had other people had my back. I felt the absolute pressure on Nightline, because it's a weird thing, because you can't be yourself, not really. You don't really go, you don't really say stuff, because nobody's there to say anything back to you. And you don't get any feedback. So from any, and I'm a real, you know, I like the back and forth.
You like the dynamic
of two.
I do,
yeah. Yeah,
which is odd,
because
it never came across that way when you were presenting. Like, as you said, it seemed like the naughty corner. Like, I remember watching TV3 Nightline compared to TVNZ and their late night offering. It was pretty drab compared to TV3's, which actually felt like it was something that you're not meant to be watching. It's not meant to be the news, but it is still. Yeah. And I felt like that was kind of the dynamic I loved about Nightline that you guys always
Me
had.
Too.
And you're right. Talents like David Farrier definitely made the difference as well, which, it's crazy to think that that era, like, existed, and that we're probably not going to see, like, a similar era probably anytime soon.
No, and look, I alluded to the fact before that a couple of years ago I got the call up to go back, and I did a couple of years back on news, what's now called News Hub Late. And, great team, worked with Jacob Bryant and my beautiful friend Lauren Hendrickson. And but it was a recut of the 6 o'clock news a lot of the time. There was still lovely camaraderie and lovely team stuff, and live interviews was the new thing. But the really telling sign about that was that, I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, but nobody knew I was doing it. So when I was on Nightline, you know, everybody, you know, I got chased in the street by paparazzi. People always, you know, the supermarket knew who you were. When I did those 2 years on News Hub Late, people would say to me, oh, what are you up to now? So it just shows the shift in viewer habits. In fact, I also did a bit of a stint on Prime, the 5:30 news, which TV3 was running for a number of years there with Eric at the helm, and I was doing a bit of a stint during the weeks when he was away and on weekends, and more people, it was just an interesting sort of barometer, not scientific, but more people would see me on that at 5:30 than they would at, and that was one of the things that late news on TV3 never got right from when I did it back in the mid early 2000s through to when I redid it, was that they never got a appointment time. It was never 10 o'clock. Sometimes it would be 11:45, sometimes it would be 9:45. So I think, and that was never resolved. But it was really interesting to me that I could do that show for a couple of years again and nobody knew.
It is odd because, this is something that I've tried to explain to people over here. Like, so here in Argentina, a lot of the people there, their equivalent of celebrities is always going to be the classic footballers, musicians and everything else in between. And people don't seem to realise that journalists are probably the big celebrities in New Zealand, especially during the early 2000s. I'll say people such as yourself, Paddy Gower, especially now.
It's the magazine covers, the big stars.
They are the magazine's covers. It's not, we don't really, well, we do care about our sports people, but the journalists are far bigger, like juicier news for us than anything else. Does it still feel kind of weird now looking back that at one point or another, you were probably cover of Women's Day, Women's Weekly, all the rest of TV Guide? Is it kind of like a weird thing to look back on and be like, I was front of
center for a lot of people? It is quite surreal, and it was an absolute vortex, you know. One of the other amazing things that used to happen before social media was that you would come into your desk, whether it was on Nightline or Sunrise or whatever show it was, Target or whatever, you'd come in each day and there would just be piles and piles of things on your desk, gifts. It'd be like, oh, there's a pair of shoes. Oh, there's a new robe. Oh, there's some jewellery. Oh, there's some socks. Oh, there's some kids' toy. And it was just, but you didn't, there was no expectation to do anything with them. There was no, you didn't have to unbox. You didn't have to social media. You didn't, I mean, I would always thank at the very least. But it was like this natural influence rather than actually having to go in and unbox and photograph and seem completely unauthentic in doing so. But that was one of the most bizarre things about those days. And yes, you know, being chased by paparazzi and I actually did, I shared with a team that I'm working with at the moment, a little bit on, who are a bit younger, and a little bit of the past, and I've got quite a few boxes actually, you know, big boxes filled with all the paraphernalia because mum started keeping them all and then I sort of began to keep them all. And I pulled out one and it was from our town, About Town in the Sunday Star Times. And, you know, they used to do all this terrible stuff, Rachel Glossina, and used to always open on Sunday to see, you know, if she called you worst dressed or what she'd done or, you know, who you had, what you hadn't been invited to or whatever it was. And there was this thing saying, which TV3 late night something or other RSVP'd to the opening of Hotel Britomart but never showed up. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Like, how freaking ridiculous. That's how much our life was under the microscope, you know, that they would feel like that was relevant to write, you know.
Is that kind of weird to think about that, like, yeah, you guys were the talk of gossip, which if you look at the UK, you got The Sun and these other papers that are well known for being sensationalist papers, but did it feel weird to be the journalists themselves became the news? That's kind of a strange dynamic.
Yeah, totally. See, that was the other thing with when I didn't set out to be a presenter and then I got the job and then suddenly, they cut your hair, they buy your clothes, you get paraded past the news bosses to make sure that the look is okay. And then once it's all okay, it's okay and off you go into the world. But past that, you don't, you know, you get phoned up. Oh, we went to a cover shoot for Australian Women's Weekly. Oh, we want you to MC Christmas in the Park in front of 500,000 people. Oh, we want you to do a cameo on Pulp Sport with Bill and Ben. Be funny. Oh, and suddenly, and so nobody was telling you how to do that, what you should be asking for in return, if anything. Often it was nothing most of the time. Certainly I, you know, was not very good at advocating for myself in that. Some things had to be run past Mark. It was just bizarre because there was no training, and that's often how I found myself, you know. One really intimate story that I am happy to share because I reflect on it all the time was there was one particular night on Nightline that I just was not very well. You know, when you peak at late night and have red lights at you at 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, five nights a week, it takes a toll. And when you're isolated, this is before children, when you're isolated from a normal working family and your normal friends because you're home during the day, it can take a toll on your mental health. And there was one particular night where I just did not feel like getting up and putting on the makeup and being the face of by myself, because I always felt like, at the end of the day, we all work hard, and then I have to lift as the producers are in the green room, you know, with in the control room with their legs up on the desk, you know, sort of going, great, we're putting the show to air, off to you. And that was the immense responsibility that you had. But there was one particular night and I just couldn't do it, and I was shaking and I was obviously quite unwell. And John Campbell came and sat down next to me and he was like, but what are you worried about? And I'm just like, I just don't feel like it tonight. I just don't have the energy, because it takes a toll, right? And he said, look, just remember, can I swear?
Yeah, you can bleep
me anyway.
Yeah, so nah, just remember,
it's not fucking brain surgery. You're not trying to cure a kid right now. And it was great perspective, and I got through that night, but it wasn't much longer after that when I was offered the chance to move to early mornings with a team where I felt like if I was having, because everyone has low energy days, but if I was having a low energy day, I had four other co-hosts in that room that could help lift me. And I think that was a much healthier space for me. And same with radio. With radio, yes, it's just you, but I would always find myself getting really curious in the moment, listening to the other person speak. So that would fill my cup, make me feel safe.
Do you also feel it's a little bit of the visual aspect as well? It's kind of like people, how they talk about, oh, we love shutting the Zoom camera off because we don't want to be on cam. It's a little mix of that as well. The fact that the attention is not always going to be on you, and you feel like you can have that moment of not having the smiling grin the whole time, that you're chuffed to be there, even though you may be going through something like really terrible at that time. So you feel like you can relax a little bit. Is it kind of a
little
bit of that?
Totally. And in maturing, like, I'm not the 24-year-old newsreader anymore, and I'm still a people pleaser and a perfectionist, but at 24, when you are, you know, being critiqued on how you look, talked about in the newsroom as being young, worried that you're going to stuff it up every night, that starts to play on you. When I got this beautiful period to return to it, sort of, you know, 15 years later, and do the late news a couple of years ago, I was way more relaxed. Good enough was on a bad day or a low energy day or a day that kids were all spewing or whatever was good enough. But I think without that perspective in my 20s, every night had to be, you know, award performing, which put too much pressure on myself. And there were external pressures as well, because, you know, we used to have this thing called the feedback logs. I don't know if anyone's ever told you about this, but the lovely receptionist at TV3. So people used to just ring and say exactly what they thought. If you said a word wrong, or if you looked wrong, or if you wore something wrong. And so you and your ad breaks, you could just look at the feedback logs and see what was being written about you live. And, you know, some of it was hilarious, but it would only take one to derail you.
I can't even imagine, because, yeah, this is pre-social, like, social media being as strong as it is in terms of live. But, like, yeah, that would definitely shake you. And I'm curious as well, was it kind of like, because you talk about your family a lot in terms of going back and how, like, that was the last thing on your mind now is focusing on the stresses and everything else. Do you feel like by having a family and having those outside activities and outside things that are happening, that you kind of compartmentalizing your life in a way and being like, this is my presenting life, it ends here, I'm not taking it home with me? Is it kind of a little bit of that as well?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, probably that's with radio, the family thing is a really good thing, because with radio you're bringing you have become, by having, you know, as you grow older you gather all of these things, be it children, homes, insurances, you know, and suddenly you've got all this life stuff that can add in and really deepen the flavor and your knowledge and your curiosity about the world. And you can also empathize, going back to being a Rarotonga, walking in other people's shoes. You can, I think you're more accessible and you're more authentic and more available to connect with other people. TV doesn't, you get that in TV off screen. So what happens when I would go into TV3 is you'd go in, you'd go straight to the makeup chair, you'd look like this, you know, and they'd go, hey, honey, just sit back and relax. And then they'd, you know, zhuzh you up for 45 minutes. You'd put your wardrobe on, you'd step into the newsroom, and that was the transition. And then you'd have your laughs and your great banter, and you're trying to one up each other on the best headlines and the best words and the funniest, most cleverest. You know, Angus Gillies, I miss riffing with him on the Daily so much. Just so good at riffing those lines. And then the delivery and, you know, all that stuff. And then you'd take your makeup off and then you'd go home and your job was done. And you'd feel a real sense of achievement because you'd had something for you done as well.
And this is another thing that, because I would have thought the exact opposite in terms of, you said that working on breakfast television for you was a lot easier. I would have seen that as more difficult, especially for a number of factors, but one of the main ones being at the time, and I hope this isn't offensive, but Sunrise was going up against a titan, which was breakfast, which now I think is still rating incredibly highly. Was there a bit of fear attached to you joining Sunrise and being like, we're going up against this behemoth that is the main breakfast show in New Zealand, being like, are we going to be able to do this? Was there a little bit of thought behind that? Or are you like, nah, we're going to do it. We're going to be
I think if you ask Sasha McNeil the same question, because we started Sunrise, right? It was myself, James Coleman was my original co-host. We had Josh Heslop as our weather dude, Rod Cheeseman as our sports dude, and Sasha McNeil was our newsreader. And she had come across from TVNZ to work on Sunrise. She had left TVNZ, so it was a big call for her. She probably, if you spoke with her, that was definitely something that was in her mind and she would remind us of. We, and I guess naively, but I didn't know. We were set up, and look, again, same as Today FM, which crumbled 18 months ago very unexpectedly, and I could list off probably five other things where this has happened. We haven't got time to talk about all the time, is that all my career's been blown up in flames. But, you know, Sunrise was the first one. I think we were a good 2.5, maybe 3 years. A year with James, a couple of years with Ollie, him and I fronting, and the other three being part of our team. No, because it was such a bloody good gig. Like, it was so much fun. And we got all the same interviews and we got all the same spoils and privileges of broadcasting from, you know, to Howard Morrison's funeral, or they'd send me to the Solomons for something, or Samoa to host live, or, you know, we went on that. We had the funness of what a breakfast show could be. And I am an optimist, I guess. So when there were chatters that it wasn't, you know, we knew that it was, you know, and ironically, if we just hung on, because then Paul did his dipshit thing and, you know, disappeared and all imploded about a week after Sunrise, who knows. But you know, it's a juggernaut. But I think we were competitive enough in that we gave people choice. Yeah, I didn't fear that it would end, and I was absolutely shocked when it did.
Because that was the thing that I was always surprised about, that I feel like Sunrise just needed more time. And do you think maybe in some respect that's kind of the problem that can occur with networks, especially now, is that they fear ratings and want to pull things as soon as it looks like it's going bad, rather than giving it the time to build an audience or to build up reputation? Do you feel like that's kind of a consistent issue sometimes, especially in New Zealand? Because I know certainly in the radio space, that seems to be a bit of a recurring theme, that as soon as anything seems like it's not doing well, they just pull the plug instead of reinvesting or changing things.
Yeah, and in two very specific circumstances that relate to Sunrise and then Today FM. Today FM lasted 18 months under the guise of the incredible Dallas Gurney, you know, absolute bigwig at ZB that set out, hired myself and many, many, many talented broadcasters. He, you know, bestowed in us that they were not going to give up. And both of those circumstances, the business, not the shows, the business was struggling. And in both of those circumstances, Kiwis do what Kiwis do, and they bring in Australian consultants spend some time, maybe a week, maybe less, looking, and then they look at what's costing the most for the least return. And unfortunately, both Sunrise and Today FM were the black marks that got, and then the Australian consultant gets on a plane and flies back to Australia. So, you know, it's probably happened to me 10 times across my career, but those two very public facing big ones were, but that's how it played out. And that's why it was so unexpected for both of those particular shows.
And it must have been quite hard as well at that point, because, yeah, as you said, it's not even a reflection sometimes on the effort or the skill of the people that have been working on the show. Sometimes it's literally just ratings and money, and that's all it is.
Yeah,
was it quite hard purely. As well at the time? Because I think you were pregnant at the time that the cancellation happened, and you were...
Yeah.
Did that add any extra stress, or was it kind of like, this is actually kind of like a nice end to that chapter so that I can spend time with my children? What was kind of the thoughts going through your mind when that all happened?
And definitely, you know, Andrew Schusterman, people like that said to me, you know, go away, have your baby, the work will come. But I'd been not a workaholic, but I'd been passionate and I'd been filling my life with working for a very long time. And one of the things about being a female broadcaster when you're pregnant, when I told Mark Dennis I was pregnant on the phone in January, he said to me, I'm going to kick your ass. So that's the kind of response that you get from a male boss who is suddenly thinking, shit, the optics, the impact, you know, it wasn't particularly supportive. So to my mind, that made me think, right, had my first baby, had been trying for 3 years unsuccessfully, but now he's shitty, so how do I make sure that I retain my seat? Because the other thing in those days, I don't know if it happens so much now, but they would put people in that were better than you or did want it more, or and there would just be this kind of, you know, it would become a contest. I have seen it done so well in more recent years than what it was done like in our times. You know, if you think about when people like Kanoa have had the amazing Laura fill in, but then they've each gone, you know, it's just been so much more, it's appeared to be so much more friendly than the way that it used to have been done, because maybe there's been more certainty due to things like, you know, legal conditions or something, I don't know. But for me, no, it put the fear of God up me that I was going to, because I was going to have my first baby, I was going to be forgotten. So then they said to me, well, we'll put you into the Breeze and you can do early morning Breeze radio with the two Robbies. So I was back with a 2 or 3 month old baby, I think, doing that. And I do regret giving that up, actually, but at the time, I'd come from pure news reading, never really was enough for me after Sunrise. It really wasn't, and it can be a doddle after, and maybe I should have just taken the doddle, but it wasn't enough for me. So, you know, getting up at half past five, home by nine, then the baby all day, just reading the news when I'd been used to doing all the interviews and meeting all the people, it wasn't enough, so I gave it up, and then that's when Target came up and went and did that, and then that was a whole new experience, but then that got pulled. It's been on air for 16 years, and it got pulled about 16 weeks into me being on it, so, oh, it was a bit of a ride. Those early few years with two small children and my self-confidence, self-worth, and career seemingly on the ropes were very, very challenging times. And financially as well, because I think a lot of people don't realise that a lot of these things, there's no redundancy. Like, you don't get any money when shows finish, typically, unless you fight, and that's not my style. So typically you get a paycheck 1 week, the show finishes unexpectedly, and then what?
I was actually going to ask this as well, because it kind of leans into very much expectations of general public and a little bit kind of touching on that, because a lot of people in the general public seem to think that journalists are these high-flying people that earn big money all the time, which, don't get me wrong, there are some on some massive paychecks, but they have to realise a lot of it is freelance, and if you get dropped, you're dropped, and then the next gig might be far away. Do you think, in a sense as well, it does feel a little bit more punishing when stuff is, like, publicised, especially, like you said, the cancellation of Sunrise, cancellation of Target, which I will say, you were fantastic on that as well. It was an iconic show, and it was incredibly stupid that they got rid of that, because I think everyone loved Target when it was on.
I think we still need it. I think we still need it now, to be honest.
I agree, thank you. I think we need it now more than ever. Brooke and you should get it back together, please.
I'll just call out to him. I'll be able to hear him from over there.
I know he's on the Bitcoin, like the Ether, Ethereum sort of stuff.
That man's brain. Yeah,
mate, get him back in there. It'd be great to see. And
it's a great show.
That was one of the things I've always found kind of weird is that public perception always seems to be, oh, journalists will always find a job. Those media people are paid well. I don't know why they're crying about it. Do you feel like that was kind of almost a reaction with the closing down of News Hub? Because I felt like people weren't as angry about it as I expected, especially because of the fact it was quite a big thing.
Yeah, and I found that a really difficult time because while I wanted and I was there to support my friends that all went through that, in some way I'd been on that slow train for about 15 years. It wasn't the entire station shutting down, but equally the entire show of Sunrise, the entire show of Target, the entire radio station of Radio Live, the entire Magic Talk radio station, the entire, you know, Cook the Book series crew, I'd had all of these little things along the way. So when that happened, I found their grief was where I had been at in 2010 when Sunrise ended. I think journalists are paid. I'll give you an example. I can give you a few examples actually. Journalists seem to get paid less and less every year. So when I came back to do the late news, I was on the same amount of contract money that I had been on when I first did it 20 years ago. When my radio show, and it's not much, and it's not much, I'm not rich, like it's not even six figures, right, to be a newsreader. I imagine people think that it's a shitload.
Yeah, exactly, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, when I did my radio show for Radio Live for 8 years, when Radio Live got axed and they made it into Magic Talk and they ax you and there's no redundancy and they say, can you do the show again next week for Magic Talk, but it will be at this rate. The rate was a third of what my original rate had been. So in my experience, money in journalism for me has never gone up. There's never been a windfall. It's always gone down. And in some ways, you're doing a harder job because you're expected to do more. You know, if you think about journalists now, they call them VJs. You know, they're out there, they've learned all the technology, they're looking at the sound, they're filming, and they're asking the questions, and they're doing a piece to camera, and they're learning how to live cross. And, you know, they're probably on 60 grand a year. So, I think, you know, the ones that are on the big ones are the ones that get OIA'd, that get outed, that are state funded. It's you'd never go into journalism for money.
I think that's always the thing that they told us at broadcasting, New Zealand Broadcasting School, is like, if you think you're going to get paid well, no, that's not happening. Expect to be permanently poor, which is okay. It's all for the love. And is that kind of why you made the decision to be a little bit more independent in terms of the work that you started doing? Because you moved away from a lot more of the traditional networks after a while, and as you said, moved into more stuff that was like lifestyle focused and a little bit more kind of in your wheelhouse. Was that kind of as a result of that being like, I kind of need to focus a little bit on me instead of trying to chase like what the networks want of me? Was that kind of the reason you decided to go on that direction?
In some way, but it's still related to self-worth. I still felt the axing of Sunrise very personally because my bosses at the time had always said, well, you'll be back. Just go and have your baby and then you'll be back. But then things changed in the media landscape. We had things like the Christchurch mosque shooting, and we had a few big things. And then, you know, things like Campbell Live got axed. And so then there wasn't really an opportunity for me to return to TV3 without doing, like, the big 10-hour shifts, which with two young children never financially made sense. So I absolutely would have gone back to a network if the opportunity had been right, but there was just never an opportunity. Oh, there goes an AirPod. So when it did come, and I think I did all of COVID and late news. That was a fantastic experience. When it did come, I jumped at it and I couldn't believe how long I kind of ruminated on seeing the newsroom as the enemy from what it had done to me, because I did take it very personally. I didn't move on, and I possibly should have got some help in figuring out how to move on better after something like that. But I had a new baby, and Yeah, I probably wallowed for way too long and didn't have enough. We've talked about this, enough self-confidence, enough self-worth, enough belief that I could, pick up the phone and go and be something again.
And it's quite a brave decision that you made to kind of get to that point that you can move forward from it, because I think for a lot of other people, and I can totally understand your feelings to it, because it could make you very jaded going through those processes and feeling like that it could have happened, what it could have been. And I kudos to you, Carly, honestly, for like continuing to move forward, because I think if you had just stayed in that position and being like, oh, well, I'm never going to go back to that sort of position, I feel like we would have missed out on a lot of things from you, which is it would have been a shame.
The unexpected bonus of going back in into the newsroom, I think it was in 2019 until about 2023, 2024, that 4 or 5 years of going back in was some of the most rewarding years that work-wise that I have had, because I didn't realize that I had stuff to offer the younger people, and I just loved it. I just really loved being in that mentoring space and not realizing that what I knew was actually quite cool and was worth passing on.
Yeah, has it become more of an identity for you that you want to see other young people, especially in
Oh.
journalism, like get to the same point that you're at now? Like, is that kind of the role that you're trying to take a little bit more, and like helping mentor, massage the people, and make them not feel like the same that you felt when you were younger entering journalism and feeling like, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly watching as an observer of when Three went down, watching how brave and how quickly a lot of them, they had their moment and then they pivoted and now they're reading the news and, Jerusalem and all these kind of amazing places. But I think it's more than that for me. My what because I still love hearing people's stories. So for me, my absolute passion is sharing others' stories and helping others feel good on stage, on screen, and heard, and also connecting people. You don't realize across a career like mine how many people you know. People will say to me, "Oh, no. Oh, introduce you to this person," and I love being a connector of people. And seeing people be brave enough to tell some hard stories or share some hard stories. I'm really loving working in that space at the moment.
And in a much larger way, I think this might be a good conversation to have. Are you seeing a much larger shift in the way that women are treated within the workplace, particularly in journalism? You touched on one thing earlier where you said your bosses were extremely, I guess you could say, hard-nosed about the fact that you're wanting to have a baby, and they're like, why would you do this to us? Do you feel there's now a bit more of a cultural shift towards how
I
women are
think
treated in the workplace,
so.
or do you feel like it's still kind of the same as it was years ago?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think there has to be, right? And maybe the shift though is in women, young women now doing what's right for them rather than doing their career first and being too worried about doing what's right for them. Because in the last couple of years, particularly in that TV3 newsroom, I would see people take opportunities that if they that previously in younger years I think people would have been too scared to leave, so actually putting themselves first. And I think I have this thing now where I've decided that I only work with good humans, and when I work with good humans, good things comes of it. I don't want to work with dickheads or assholes or people that aren't good humans. And when I use that barometer, and if I look at the newsroom, all of the good humans are still there. The assholes have kind of gone.
And that's interesting you say that, because I'm guessing that's also been the reason why you've managed to return so many times, and probably the reason why a lot of your old managers have said the same thing, being like, Carly, you're going to come back. Like, there is a way that you're going to come back and you're going to be in media again. And was there ever a time where you felt worried about that, or did you realize at some point, because you'd made so many good connections, there was always going to be someone that you could
Oh
maybe
no.
hit up and be like, hey, mate,
No,
is there any
always
chance you can let me
worried.
know if there's something new?
No,
Always
always
worried.
worried. And I'm still doing it. I reached out to staff recently because I'm like, okay, the dust has settled. I wonder how they're getting on in there. Beautiful Lisette Raymer is working in there. I love that girl. There's so many great people working in there that I'd love to try and offer something to. And no, I'm still doing that. I again, it's just a stupid blooming self-confidence thing. I do not have I'm gonna try to be a bit more proactive with getting myself back into working with good humans purposefully, because who did I hear on a podcast say recently? They were talking about John McDonald at TV3, who used to be the bigwig and run all of the sort of lifestyle-y shows at TV3. And this person, I can't remember who it was, might have been Petra Baggest, talked about if you weren't in John's face, like on the daily, and like to the point of annoying him, he would just forget because he had so many other things and so many other people harassing him, haranguing him. And I've never been that person. And I think in some ways I wish I had have been, because there are certainly some opportunities that I should have gone for just to get me out of my funk, because my funk lasted a little bit too long.
And I wanted to also shift a little bit to talking about your family, because you've mentioned earlier your husband and you worked together very early on in your career. You're still married now. You've got a beautiful family, kids, and everything else like that. How has that been, having a relationship with someone else who's working in the same industry fundamentally? Has it always been a conflict, or have you felt like because you've both worked in the same industry, it's actually meshed well together because you both have this mutual understanding?
Yeah, definitely the latter. I mean, I don't know any other friend couples that we've got that can accept that, Sunday morning we're planning to do this and suddenly Dave's on a plane somewhere, or I would be having to do a shift on a public holiday that wasn't time and a half because it was a contract rate, or, like we, and when we've had the downs, plenty, plenty and plenty of downs, Dave's an amazing reader of human behavior. And I think it comes from being a cameraman. We often joke that if him and I are on the tools together and I'm interviewing somebody and he's behind the camera and he's mic'd them up, I get the amazing version of the person and Dave gets the not so amazing version of the person. So he will hear things, he will see things, he will observe things. He's an amazing observer of human behavior. Whereas because I'm just there trying to get people to like me and trying to get them to share their story or whatever, and he will come to the end of it and he'll go, oh yeah, no, that person was okay. Oh yeah, a little bit this. And even in our day-to-day circle, he can clock people way before me. So it's been very complimentary, and he's been very understanding because Dave's been a real rock, and he's done a very similar job for all sorts of different companies across the years, but very similar. Whereas I've been more like this, and you add the three kids and the hormones and all that kind of thing into it, and Dave is an absolute stabilizer of our family and of me. So it has absolutely worked. I don't know how it would have worked otherwise. Particularly with things like the grief of things, he's been amazing.
And the post-conflabs after meetings, I'm guessing you two have really mastered that. So the kind of like breaking down of people being like, what did you think? What did you think of that person? What's your opinion on that? Has that become like a bit of a ritual for you two? Like in terms of being like, you come across with the positive aspects. He's like, no,
I
you've got to
do,
be
I
giving
do,
a...
I do. Yeah. I pick my moments because, and because of that, like that's a bit of a blind spot of mine as well, because I'm so invested in trying to make, so my thing is I want to make people feel comfortable on camera or on air. Like I want to make them feel comfortable so that it's not this big scary thing and we can just connect like you and I just now. Like you've tried to make me feel like we know each other personally and for years. It's exactly, on the sunrise couch, you'd get Helen Clark arriving during another interview, being shuffled in next to you, or somebody that's never been on television before, and there's no chance to even like shake hands or say hello off camera because they are boom straight on camera. So that's my natural ability, I guess, is to warm people up and to try and get the best out of them. But in doing so, and trying to people please and make them the best they can be, I often forget some of the fundamental things. So Dave will just pop up and go, ah, you actually haven't asked about that XYZ, or can you just do that again? Or yeah, it's good. We don't like working together too often these days. I get frustrated. I get frustrated.
I guess it's a classic thing of like never
He
work
probably
with a
does
partner.
too.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I was going to
he
say,
probably does
because you were
too.
his boss at one point. So he's like, damn, I have to ask Carly for a raise again. Oh, God.
I know. I'm always I'm always I and I think most journalists and people that work in TV would agree. I'm always absolutely confounded by how long it can take to set up and how much gear is required. and I just get there and I'm ready to go. But you need to build that time in, because that is their part of their craft, where they want the lighting to be perfect, they want the batteries to be charged, that, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I just have to be a little bit more patient sometimes, which means a lot more small chat for me while Dave's doing all the heavy lifting.
Also, in a way, is the people pleasing sort of like the vulnerability that you feel makes people a lot more comfortable when they are getting interviewed by you, because they know that you're trying to like put yourself out there and be like,
I'm trying to
get in here, I'm trying to understand you and get to know you better as a person.
And I think knowing the reputation of journalists, that's never been my style, to be that reputation of a journalist, which is that I'm trying to catch you out, I'm trying to whatever, and I, you know, there aren't too many working journalists I know these days in my circles that are like that. So, but that is the, you know, if you think during COVID times, you know, all of that perception and the Tova, then Jenna and all, you know, all that kind of stuff, it's, we have to work hard, because, and my podcast that I was doing, that I'm hoping to redo, was called What You Don't Know About. Cause what I find is, and you know, curious with you, like, when you went to research me, so how I would approach that with my guests would be I would Google them and then just try and go off what I got off Google, just to see how much is wrong, and also my own perception. People have their perceptions of people that are in the public eye, and the podcast was to go beyond that, to try and get to know people and who they really are without just being that public persona.
And in terms of the interviews that you've done for your podcast, where do you think public perception has been the complete opposite of what the actual person is really like?
Oh, you know, Judith Collins was an amazing interview.
I can imagine that
would have been really good ones, actually. She's an absolute mummy's girl, and she went to like elocution school, and she's very, very generous. Just constantly surprised, and we always finish our podcast with what's one thing that you haven't ever told anybody, and there is a very well known is she a high court judge or a crown prosecutor, Marie Dyberg, who at the end decides to share with us her very prolific, expansive sex life, which was absolutely mind-blowing, and not something you expected from this prim and proper,
of course not,
very well-known public prosecutor. So yeah, but working them up into that space to be willing, you know, Robin Malcolm had the most amazing chat with Robin Malcolm just before her anxiety TV series came out, and hers, I mean, she cried because hers was that she'd actually had an anxiety attack on the way into the studio, and she wasn't going to make it. And then she thought, I need to do it. So, yeah, I mean, humans are humans, and we all have stories, and we all have our dark things and our worries and our quirky things, and our, no one is who you expect. And I just love learning more and more about good humans.
And I was going to say, is that something that you feel has like grown with you the longer that you've been working in this sort of industry, that there's constantly always surprises, people aren't as they appear, maybe in front facing sort of roles. And in terms of that, what do you think is one of the things that you feel a lot of people don't know about you, Carly, or what's something that you think is a misconception that a lot of people have had from working with you in the workplace?
Yeah, I wonder if it's confidence. I wonder if people think that I am, you know, a showy hand, confident, can stand up on stage. I interviewed Graham Norton. I hosted Graham Norton for an hour last week on stage. I was shitting myself. Like, 2 days before, like, I am not, you know, I expel energy, but then I have to go and get my energy back. So I am not confident. I am still, you know, I have hosted so many things, and yet I still have the same fears that anybody who's doing it for the first time probably has, I think.
In terms of next steps, Carly, because you said that the podcast, it's something you've always wanted to go back to. It was a project that you started, and I definitely see it coming back, and I hope it comes back very soon. What are the next steps for you, Carly? What is going to be happening in the near future for you?
Well, the last year or so, I have taken on a contract working with a big corporate here in New Zealand, and I have been helping them build up their public speakers and shape their events and help people tell their vulnerable stories and make some pretty cool videos for them. But we have had a caravan for our. I wonder if I should say this out loud. Yes, I can. I will. I'll be brave.
Go on.
We've always loved caravanning. We've had combis and caravans and whatever. And last year it just wasn't working. We've got a 14-year-old, 13-year-old, an 8-year-old, and they just don't like all being in the caravan at the same time together anymore. And they have lots of weekend sport. And we're just in that rut at the moment. So we sold the caravan, didn't pay the money back to the bank. That's probably what I shouldn't say. And we've booked us flights to for the five of us to come and have a month in Europe in the middle of June just to reset and hopefully get some perspective, catch up with some London journo mates, among other things, and just take some time out to reset what the next bit of our lives could look like because we're both a little bit lost at the moment. And yeah, there's more to life than working 9 to 5 for a big corporate, I reckon. So, watch this space.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at BeyondBroadcastPod or via email at BeyondBroadcastPod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.